What are some of the myths of gospel reductionism? I've written part two of an article titled Better Than Good, Failed Attempts to Improve on the Gospel in the latest issues, etc. journal. We'll send it to you for free. Just click the red journal subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. In the Wittenberg Trail feature, Joy Pullman of The Federalist writes about her journey from charismatic experientialism to confessional Lutheranism. The free online Issues Etc. journal. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. On this Wednesday afternoon, February the 22nd, we're going to talk Christians, contraception, and the future of the family. What will American society look like in 50 years if we stay on the demographic trend that we have set ourselves on? There's no doubt about it. We've set ourselves on this trend. Sometimes demographics are the result of conditions beyond our control, but this one is not beyond our control. In fact, it's largely the result of our trying to exercise control where probably the American family, especially Christian families, have no business exercising control. Joining us to talk about contraception and the future of the family, especially as Christians, Pastor Jonathan Fisk. He's host of a radio program called His Time. He's creative director of Worldview Everlasting TV, author of the book Broken, Seven Christian Rules That Every Christian Ought to Break as Often as Possible. And he made a presentation at a recent LCMS Life conference titled Demographic Winter and the Church That Prays for Summer. Jonathan, welcome back.
Yeah, it's good to be in studio.
So what does American society look like if we stay on the demographic rails we have set ourselves on?
Right. And this is in some ways the biggest bomb that I'll probably drop at all today. And the most important thing to understand about demographics is you can't not stay on the demographic rails that you're on. When you don't have enough children in a generation, you can't go back and have more children for that generation. We can't make more 20-year-olds right now. We can't make more 40-year-olds right now. We can only make more 0-year-olds. And that would be even 9 months from now. So 50 years from now, let me just go with the numbers from the UN projection, which is that in 2050, the world will reach the peak population of growth, which is what, if you listen to people who are kind of the fanatics about there being population growth, they're right that currently the numbers are going up. And by 2050, we're going to reach 9.1 billion people on the planet. But we're not going up because we're having more people. We're going up because less people are dying. Their healthcare has made it so that people are just living longer. And so when we hit 9.1 billion people in 2050, 7 billion of those will be over the age of 65. So if you can imagine a pyramid inverted on itself so that you have the point on the bottom and the base on the top, that's what our population will look like. And again, 9 billion people, 7 billion over 65. Let's say they all live 30 years. Even at that time, living 30 years further down the road, you're going to have within a 5 to 20 year period, 7 billion people dying, which drops us down in the range of 2 billion people. And then here's the problem. That 2 billion that remains is reproducing at the same rates that are causing this problem, which is that we're not reproducing enough people per family to continue to grow. And so that 2 billion will be continuing to get smaller as the pyramid point goes kind of deeper and deeper and deeper until somehow we magically turn around and start reproducing at the rate we need to, which that rate, that number, and this is science, this is math, there's really no way around this number. That number is 2.13 children per household, beginning at a young age. Because if you, 20s and 30s, when you're having your kids, if you're waiting until your 40s, you're actually extending that generation gap, you need more kids. So most of the planet right now, with the exception of the continent of Africa, and a few small people groups such as the Amish, are well below that 2.13 number. Even the United States, which is almost stable, is at 2.09, I think, is that right? I forget. I just wrote that on a blackboard yesterday, but I don't remember. So anyway, if we can't get off this track. This is just it. This is a future that is written. What we can do is recognize what it means, recognize what it's going to, what kind of impact it's going to have on the world economy. We should probably talk about that. What do you do in an economy that's built for 7 billion people when you have 2 billion people left? Who's driving the trucks? Who's running the hospitals? Who's teaching in the schools? You have all these this infrastructure you've created that doesn't really have people for it anymore. So you got that issue. And then you got the issue of the church itself. And you look at the numbers, say, for the Missouri Synod, where we do not have, we're not doing any better. And so we have buildings closing, churches closing, schools closing already. what happens then if we don't kind of turn this around and at least care to pass something forward?
But even before that, when we have that, what, two-thirds of the world's population?
Yeah.
Over 65?
Yeah.
I don't know of an economy that can survive.
That.
I mean, unless 2 billion people supporting another 7 billion people
right.
who are either in retirement, and let's just face it, they're not all going to retire like the golden parachute.
You won't be able to.
Or in nursing homes or something like that.
Yeah.
I foresee not just economic disaster. I see some really bad ideas on how to solve that economic problem.
Well, yeah, you already got euthanasia coming down the pipe, right? And it's just going to get easier and easier for those without a Christian worldview to say, well, they're a drain on society. Let's put them to sleep. I don't know how we avoid that. You might even come to a point where as a Christian, that's what happens to you. Like, you're going to be put to sleep because that's what they're doing to people your age, and you will have no recourse legally to deal with it. It's a good reason to vote against it now, in my opinion, because by then it'll be too late.
So we're not talking about the distant future. We're talking about the future that includes, what did you say, 2050?
2050 is when it peaks, right? 9.1 billion people. This is UN projected numbers. And then at that time, 7 billion are over the age of 65.
So that is 33 years from today.
Right.
How old will you be?
I do that math, I would be 71.
You're going to be 71.
Yeah.
And you're going to be among those people that will either be the wards of the state or
yep.
the candidates for euthanasia.
I'm telling my kids I'm living with them and they have to feed me. But you're right. I mean, will they be able to do that? You know, and this is kind of, again, to try to paint the picture, this is a very crass metaphor. It doesn't quite fit. But like it's not, this isn't scientific based, but it gets you the kind of the picture of how bad things will be for the economy. Imagine today all the people that it takes to get food from a farm to a table, from the farmer, the farm hands, people loading the truck driver, people unloading the truck, people putting it on the shelves or canning it or whatever in the factory, to the checker that's working for you. Remove two-thirds of all of those people, and best case scenario, you got a truck in the parking lot selling you overpriced food right out of the back of the truck. And that's talking about what we might call blue-collar labor. What about medical profession? What about law profession? What about technology development? All of those are going to shrink, and it's not just that you'll have less people, so more opportunities. It's the other way around. The other jobs that are needed to make the jobs work won't be there, and so things won't be done because you won't have the support system for the work that we want to do. Does that make sense?
Yeah. We've been told for decades now, Jonathan, the danger in the American future is not underpopulation, but overpopulation. What's your response?
Yeah, it's a myth, and it always has been. You got a guy named Robert Malthus in the 1800s that started saying we were going to be starving if we didn't stop having children right away. He wrote some books about that, and none of his predictions came true, but those ideas kind of trickled down into the eugenics movement. People like Margaret Sanger and others began to talk about the danger of overpopulation, particularly among the savages, right? The non-Anglos, which sadly, part of eugenics was very much a racist point of view. And then you have this guy named Ehrlich, who in the 60s, in order to promote an environmentalist agenda, takes Malthusian ideas, and he writes this book called The Population Bomb. Again, without any demographic science background, without any real proof, he just makes these bold sweeping claims that there's too many people on the planet, we'll be starving by the mid-70s. And none of his predictions come true, but it scares a bunch of people, and it becomes somewhat the agenda of the UN. There's a great set of videos out there called The Demographic Winter and The Demographic Bomb. And the second one, The Demographic Bomb, they interview Ehrlich, and he admits that we're already flipped into the decline. And he kind of also admits that he's not sure how you can fix it and that it's a problem. It was easier to stop the people from procreating than to get them to procreate again. And we should maybe talk about that, how even countries like Russia and Sweden, which will pay you to have children, it doesn't work. It's not fixing their numbers. But he kind of chuckles in an uncomfortable way and says, yeah, not sure what we're going to do about that. So even the guy who propagated the myth and is very proud of it isn't quite sure now what that means. Now, he also is coming from I can't say he's an atheist, but certainly a secularist worldview in which if you are an environmentalist, you tend to see humans as a problem for the planet. So a bunch of humans dying doesn't really bother you so much because you want the environment to be sustained. That's your priority. As Christians, we give human life a priority over and against that. And so we definitely have a different take than he does.
In the response to that overpopulation scare, have we already, by another name, implemented, in effect, a eugenic solution, which we call abortion on demand.
Yeah, abortion on demand and even birth control, right? And Sanger wanted both of these things, and she wanted them particularly in the African-American community, and then in Africa itself is where the UN push really went. The irony of ironies in all of this is that this racist Anglo agenda to stop the black from growing was believed by the Anglo and has been applied to Anglo civilization. And the one continent on the planet right now that is not decreasing is Africa. They're the one place with a healthy birth rate. And of course, the UN still is all about the mission of bringing birth control to Africa.
But they haven't bought what we're selling.
But they're not. And you can listen to them in the videos as well. People from... politicians from states like Cameroon are basically saying, we don't want your mistakes. Stay out of here. You know, we're going to do what we're going to do. And if you look at what that means for the global economy, when this whole craziness happens, whatever it means, I can't prophesy what it's going to mean. But when it happens, it's going to hit everybody, including Africa, an undeveloped region or a less developed region, but they'll come out of it because they'll have a workforce to come out of it with, whereas regions like ours will actually just will have nothing to fall back on. I mean, you can say we're going to have immigration fix it, but that'll run out eventually too. And it has shown that immigrant families that move to the United States adopt our birth control practices within a generation.
We got about a minute and a half here before we take a break. Why have we done this? I mean, this seems just a matter of running the numbers once or twice to check for any major errors and to realize how bad an idea not procreating at least a replacement level
right.
is. Why have we done it?
I don't know. All I can speak for or at is where I was as a young man and where I think most young Americans are, is that I see the reality that children will be a hindrance to my own personal immediate wealth and pleasure. And I don't want that. I don't want to make that sacrifice. And I'm certainly not thinking about the future of global society, right? I'm thinking about if I have another kid, I have to buy a car I can't afford. And that's, you know, that's with several children. I'm thinking about how a kid's going to keep me up at night, or I'm going to feel busier. My wife maybe won't be able to go back to work soon enough. We won't have enough money. Those are the things that I'm thinking about. And those have been the priorities of American culture for a long time.
Pastor Jonathan Fisk is our guest. We're talking about Christians, contraception, and the future of the family on this Wednesday, February the 22nd. We're coming to you live. And if you would have a question or a comment, feel free to give us a call. This break is a great time to call us, 1-877-623-6943, or send us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org. Send us a tweet at @issuesetc, or use the Issues Etc. comment line, 618-223-8382. He's host of a radio program called His Time. He's creative director of Worldview Everlasting TV, author of the book, Broken, 7 Christian Rules That Every Christian Ought to Break as Often as Possible. You can find out more about this book at our website, issuesetc.org. Just click Listen on Demand or give Concordia Publishing House a call and order Broken, 7 Christian Rules That Every Christian Ought to Break as Often as Possible, or just say Broken, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or again, you can browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org. When we come back, that's what it's going to look like, because we have set the train on the rails and the train can't leave those rails. What would it have looked like had we not aborted the tens of millions we have over the last 40 years here in the United States alone? We'll talk about that after this.
Daily exercise for the Christian mind. You're listening to Issues Etc.
In a world awash with all sorts of information, opinions, and ideas, there is still a place where God's Word is the central and only focus. Messiah Lutheran Church, 801 North Madison, Lebanon, Illinois. At 9 o'clock on Sunday mornings, God's people gather there to listen to Him. There you will find His words of law and gospel, and of course, our Lord's Holy Supper. Bible classes focus on the Bible and the Lutheran confessions. Come, listen, believe, and live, and check out our website at messiahlebanon.org.
At Concordia University Irvine, you can pursue advanced theological study for academic, professional, or personal development. Concordia's Master of Arts in Theology program is grounded in the truth of Scripture and insights from the Lutheran confessions. Courses are taught online and at intensive on-campus sessions in the summer. Apologetics, Christian education leadership, and Reformation studies are just a few of the emphases offered. For more information,
Visit cui.edu/theology. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking with Pastor Jonathan Fisk here in the studio on this Wednesday afternoon about Christians, contraception, and the future of the family. Before the break, we were talking about what will happen. Unless Christ returns.
Right.
We are looking at certain numbers are going to play themselves out simply because, as you said, you can't go back and replace population that you didn't conceive 20 years ago.
Right.
Can't make more 20-year-olds. What would it have looked like in the future, 50 years from now, or even now, today,
right,
had we not, at least here in the United States, been aborting most of our kids, two-thirds of our
right.
kids?
Right. Well, I'm not privy to what that number would mean directly, but being that we're almost at replacement level as a, now this is with the immigration as well, as a nation, I can only imagine that we would be above that replacement level as a nation. When you talk about one-third of a generation, and really it's almost two generations now, being kind of just wiped off the map by abortion, that's a tremendous number of hands. It's a tremendous number of minds that would have been good for us. And then if you were to then include in that number, again, it's not just abortion that did this. It was the choice to control our birth numbers and to go down to two children per family as what we call the nuclear family, which is below replacement level. I don't know for the life of me why they didn't make three children the nuclear family, because that would have at least kept you at replacement level. But we didn't do that. And so it's what happens if you have every family having three children is, well, you'd have a lot more people. It doesn't mean you'd be overpopulated, though. One of the other strange facts of history is that the more population growth you see in any area, the more innovation you see. And so there's more inventors, there's more tinkerers, there's more clever minds. So you come up with things that make life feasible, and especially things like food. That's not even a question. We could easily provide enough food for the whole world right now with the science and agriculture that we have. Of course, GMO or whatever, but it could be done. So we would have, but would we have more traffic in the cities? We'd probably have more cities, you know? Yeah, would we have small towns disappearing? Maybe not. You would certainly just have more people, and that wouldn't be a bad thing unless you're anti-human, which that begs the question, right? Don't we live in an anti-human age?
Well, I guess that's the other thing that you mentioned briefly before, but I think we need to talk about it. There is an overarching idea in our politics, in our sociology, in our worldview that says the planet matters more than its inhabitants.
Right.
And so if we can prove in the short term that human population does some sort of short-term damage to the population, ergo, we need to sacrifice population for the sake of the planet or the environment. How does that play into this?
Well, I think it's very much behind the minds that created this philosophy in the first place. It's very much behind the elitist assumptions that are running and continuing to run with this mythology. The irony in that for me is always everyone's willing to say someone else needs to be sacrificed. It's when it's me that it doesn't quite hit home. I saw something recently. It was a conservative talk show host doing sort of crank calls to liberal congregations that are coming out publicly to advocate for more refugees being let into the country. And the call was pretending to be a refugee service asking them to house the refugees themselves. And they were unequivocally turned down by all of these congregations. Oh, no, we can't do it ourselves. And I think that's kind of what the real issue is. So it's very easy to talk big about sacrifices that need to be made when it's somebody else. It's another thing to put yourself in those shoes. And the agenda is always being run from the top. I'll just talk about Bernie Sanders again, too, about the 1%, a gentleman who has several multi-hundred-thousand-dollar homes, a wife who works for a massive college that brings in a huge income. He's not exactly outside of that 1%, yet he'll talk about how the rest of us need to build up and help everybody else out. And so it's a mentality in our civilization right now that I will protect my own to the last, but that everyone else needs to sacrifice for the sake of, well, whatever. Again, it's an ideology, whatever mythology I happen to believe in at the moment.
So let's talk about this as it's played itself and will play itself out in the church.
Hmm.
The church is always concerned about spreading the message of the gospel that more would hear.
Hmm.
And yet the church has, and here we are talking probably across the board with the exception of maybe a few Roman Catholics, but even then they've bought into it too, even though their church teaching is pretty strong on the issue of contraception, birth control. A church that says
No, I don't think procreation is necessarily going to be a priority for me. What does that mean for the future of the church?
The same thing it means for any culture that decides not to procreate, which is that that culture will shrink in and of itself, right? I mean, in an ideal dream, you would be able to evangelize your way out of that. The history of evangelism, the history of Christian conversion is a pretty speckled thing. You just never know when the Spirit's going to make a big win, and you never know when nothing's going to happen. Some seasons are in, some seasons are out. So the future of that culture that is the church still relies on, and historically relies on, procreating. And if you think about mission, I mean, why on earth would we believe that mission is only to those who are outside of our walls? Why is mission to your children, why is the evangelization of your children not counted, right? It's almost derided, which is really kind of a weird thing. Here you have a captive audience. You got someone who can't say no for a while, at least, right? Why would you not teach them in the way they should go? It clearly is commanded in Scripture to raise children in the fear and admonition of the Lord. So a body or a group, whether it's a congregation, whether it's a church body, whether it's Christianity as a whole, that decides, nope, three children per family, not going to do it, is a group that is effectively making the decision to cease existing within several generations. It's not going to happen in one generation, but it will invert that pyramid, get smaller and smaller. And you want to talk mission, then you got less missionaries. You got less people to send, right? Less preachers to send out, less people to confess the faith, less people to marry. We're already seeing this now. Young Lutherans have trouble finding Lutherans to marry. I actually get emails about it semi-regularly because of whatever public face I have. You know, can you find someone for me? No, I can't. I don't know. Go to a taboo conference or whatever. LCMSU, try to meet somebody. But it's increasingly difficult.
And yet, when this is raised, and you and I have both observed Pastor Matt Harrison, president of the Lutheran Church of Missouri Synod, very carefully, very gently raised this issue, using real facts and numbers from our church's own districts,
right,
saying, look, here's where the districts have grown, and here we are talking about the demographics of those counties,
right,
in that district in terms of their procreation. And there's an exact parallel there.
Right.
We cannot deny the connection. And he gets booed down,
right,
and laughed at by his fellow churchmen every single time. What's going on here?
Well, I mean, I don't want to judge hearts, but I've seen it. I know what you're talking about. And I was very encouraged that he put this in his report to Synod. And it, very astutely, there was nothing malicious. It really is the same message as I have here is like, look, this is coming. We just got to face it for what it is. If we can't walk into this together, it's going to blow us away. All that said, there are few powers in the Christian's life as sweeping as guilt. And when we have made a practice for a time of doing something, and let's take it away from the specific issue, it doesn't matter what it is. When I have done something for a decade or 15 years or 20 years or even 2 years, and I've done it believing it's good, you come along and you tell me that it's bad, my justification has just been infringed upon. And as Christians, we don't try to justify ourselves. It's not like we theologically are out there like, I'm going to live in self-justification. But we do it as sinners every day, constantly justifying the way we do. It's why we argue with each other. You know, it's why in families you get defensive with each other, because we're justifying ourselves. And so now you got something that's been a generation of practice, right? That since the 60s, when LCMS did a really amazing about face on the birth control pill, because we did stand against it quite strongly, even calling it sin, which I won't do. But we did an about face, and for a generation, it was just kind of laissez faire, let it go. Well, it's hard to come to grips with someone telling you that that was a mistake, and maybe even let's go beyond mistake to wrong. And so the easy reaction of guilt to the accusation that it's feeling is scoffing and anger. I mean, and that's what we do. That's what the sinner always does. And I'm not calling these any individuals particularly sinners. I'm saying we're all like this. That when I have a guilty conscience, if I'm not going to acknowledge it, own it, and leave it at the foot of the cross, I'm going to have to shout it down. And it seems that's what you see, because it's so unreasonable to look at this math and not just be like, huh, that math's really scary, we need to face this, but instead to act like it's some sort of insanity. The insanity is to keep doing the same thing that's brought us here without ever questioning it, regardless of, especially as people who believe in grace, as people who believe in forgiveness of sins, why would I not face my mistake and leave it at the foot of the cross? That's what I want to do. I want to be, what is it, rebuke a wise man and he'll be wiser still. So that makes, I mean, my fear for us here is like, do we have enough grace to even, and this isn't even about procreation at all. As Missouri Synod, have we lost grace so much that we can't even walk forward? We always have, we're in a body that is built on self-justification and propping that up. I mean, that's a terrifying thing for people who claim to be Lutherans.
This comes from Barbara via email. She says, when people made remarks about our family of eight and overpopulation, I'd always tell them to do the math. The entire population of the world could fit within the space a little bigger than Texas, giving everyone 2,000 square feet. That's a little bit bigger than, that's smaller than this. No, that's larger than the size of my house. So everybody gets a house of their own.
Right.
A pretty big house of their own.
You'd have to be in Texas, though.
In which they live. And she says, they were always shocked. And still they are. What you're discussing is frightening for my children and my grandchildren. What would you say to her?
Yeah, well, I mean, I say I feel it because I got five of my own. Would have liked more. This looks like this is what we're going to have. But I know they're going to live in this world. And my biggest concern is not that they are economically solvent in 2065. My biggest concern is that they hold to the Christian worldview in 2065. And I don't know what that means for how what they're going to have to face. How are they going to find spouses? How are they going to have churches? Are there going to be churches for them to go to? I mean, I in my more radically insane moments, I contemplate moving to Africa just because there'll be people there and there's Lutherans there, right? And I don't know. I mean, my consolation to you is that Jesus has said, I will build my church. He said, I'll never leave you nor forsake you. That in the catechesis that we give them in the Ten Commandments, the Creed, and the Lord's Prayer, they are equipped for all things. Luther calls them capable of judging all things. And we should believe that and continue to give them that, trusting that whatever comes, he's with us and he's holding the church in the palm of his hand. The image at the beginning of Revelation where you see the seven stars and the seven lampstands with Christ, the meaning of that picture is that no matter what it looks like, and by the way, those seven churches were enduring some severe persecution, no matter what it looks like, Christ is in control of this thing and he's got us. But he's got us by means of his word, which is law and gospel, which is part of that law, Eighth Commandments, about honesty. And that gospel, the theology of the cross there, sets us free to call things what they are. And so what we don't want to do is pretend that this isn't what it is and prepare our children for some fantasy world in which a four-year college education is going to protect them from everything that could come their way when it these days seems like more and more a four-year college education is going to strip them of what they need most.
You have anticipated my next question, which we'll get to on the other side of the break. Part of this is the American dream, folks. We have college and career as a promise that's been laid out that seems to be the inalienable right of every American child. Is that a false promise? We'll talk about it with Pastor Jonathan Fisk as we discuss Christians, contraception, and the future of the family after this.
College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois offers ACT, SAT, and PSAT test prep, scholarship application classes, college and career counseling, and more. Hi, this is Lori Konski, president of College Preparation Station. We have helped our students obtain more than $7 million in tuition scholarships in 12 years. Find out more at cpsprep.com. Let us help you create a vision and find your future. The College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois, cpsprep.com.
At Zion Lutheran Church, Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin, we've adopted the motto, A Changeless Christ for a Changing World. While many congregations try to market a message that appeals to what a changing world wants, we continue to give a constantly changing world what it needs. A changeless Christ in word and sacraments like the church has done for 2,000 years. If you're in Chippewa Falls and would like to have the forgiveness of sins, eternal life, and salvation that Jesus won on the cross and delivers today in his church, please join us poor, miserable sinners. For more information, visit cfzionlutheran.com.
Real Reformation Radio. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Are you tired of working nights, weekends, and odd hours trying to cover your bases at home just to make ends meet? At the Cleaning Authority, we call that the multi-job shuffle, and we want to end that for you right now. We'll train you in our proven, efficient cleaning methods, and you'll be partnered to work in pre-qualified homes. Call 314-416-8117 and walk away from the multi-job shuffle with a future in our St. Louis office, 314-416-8117.
If you're like me, you remember when education was about the basic skills of reading, writing, and arithmetic, and about reading great literature and history that gave our kids models of what it is to be a good person. Memoria Press's Classical Christian Curriculum is bringing this kind of education back. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Pastor Jonathan Fisk is our guest. We're talking about Christians, contraception, and the future of the family. Jonathan, you mentioned something before the break that was rolling around in my head during your last answer, and that was this promise, and it's not just a promise, it's a duty, that every red-blooded American kid from the suburbs seems to have imposed upon him, and that is you're going to go to college, and then you're going to have a career. And how old is your oldest kid?
12.
Okay. So you have yet to experience this,
Me. 11. 12.
12, I think.
12, you're right.
You've got five. You forget a few. So you have yet to experience this. If you were to send your oldest child to a public school or even to a private school, you would discover very quickly that their freshman year, they're told they have to figure out what they're going to do for the rest of their life.
Yeah, right.
Not their freshman year of college, their freshman year of high school. And that's the focus. College-oriented, career-oriented. But you have a different idea about this, especially facing what we're going to be facing here in terms of our demographics. What is it?
Yeah, I want to preclude this by saying that I'm not against college education at all. I'm not against higher education especially. What I'm against is blindly following a path that the world has set for us without questioning it or running it through the critical thinking of our catechetical beliefs. And so in this sense, I'm certainly against spending $42,000 a year to have the gender studies classes brainwash my children. Yeah. We're trying to get what is the different idea I have for this? You know, I experienced the same thing that you just said my kids would experience in school. I grew up with that. And it was an absolute assumption of mine. I never didn't enter my mind that I could do something other than go to college, such as say, go just get work with some local business and try to get some hands-on experience, which, by the way, when you graduate college, that's what they're looking for on your job application a lot of the times. Get some hands-on experience and just start applying. It never crossed my mind to be an entrepreneur. And I'm so jealous now. I listen to these podcasts from various entrepreneurs, these guys who build things like WordPress. And these guys, they either went to college briefly and dropped out or they didn't go. They just started playing with computers. And now they're millionaires. And I'm sitting there thinking, man, I wasted a lot of time. You know, I was a little late to try to catch up. So as I look at, you know, how to help my children retain their Christian faith into the future, one of the open questions in my system is, well, is college the best way to do that? And when I say college, I mean college kind of conventionally the way we think of it.
Pack them up, send them off to school. Yeah. The college watches them binge drink and indoctrinates them for 4 years, and then they hand them back to you with no job.
Yeah, I send my 18-year-old daughter out to the frat boys and the evolution teacher, and hope she comes back 4 years later. And I should say this: usually it's connected to going to go to my alma mater or the school where she can get the sports thing that she really wants to get. And regardless of whether or not there's a good church nearby, and there's going to be regular Sunday attendance, well, we'll figure that out afterwards, right? But usually the college is picked long before they look at churches. So in my own approach to this, and I'm not saying it's something other people have to do, but it's something I'm personally aware of for my kids, it's just not an assumption that they're going to go to college. It's an assumption we're going to try to equip them as best we can to live in this world, working with their hands as they can, marrying Christians and waiting for our Lord Jesus to return. And if that means college, then so be it. But there's other options than pack them up, send them out. There are plenty of colleges now that are, including one of our Concordias, Mequon, I believe, that are offering the entire four-year degree online. You have junior colleges as well that enable you to cheaply, efficiently get some of that basic curriculum done while also providing a home environment that's stable and making sure they go to church on Sunday. And so we haven't made any decisions yet, but we are openly talking about this with our kids. And we're certainly not going to give them this belief that of the five things you need most out of life, one is a college education. And let me kind of shift that again to another experience I had. I was privileged to speak at a youth conference. Let it be unnamed. It was a small one, though, 2 years ago. And I had a part of it was a breakout session with both the boys and the girls, and we were supposed to talk about abstinence and purity and all this kind of stuff. And I did that. I'd certainly encourage them to keep the sixth commandment. But I also wanted to talk about the value of childbearing. And I asked the question to both groups. I said, you know, tell me, raise your hand and tell me, what's the most important goals of your life? And with both group, I let them go until we had about five things. And it was things like get a good career, have a house, marriage sometimes came up. But for neither the boys nor the girls, and you're talking from seventh graders up to sophomores in high school, not a single one said children. And so in each case, I said, now, have you ever thought of having children as being a primary goal of life? And they all shake their head no. And then I just go, well, let me encourage you to consider that this might be something that's really valuable in a multitude of ways. From again, I didn't go into the economy stuff, but it's good for the economy, but also it's good for you. We could talk about this too. Very few things in life prepare you to be willing to serve other people like having one you have to serve. and a child is definitely that right away. It brings you outside of yourself. It teaches you to have a selfless love. And so it's good in so many ways, but it's disturbing to me that you would have both young boys and young girls that's not even on their radar. Or I've gotten questions through Worldview Everlasting from young women basically saying, I don't want to have children. Is that okay? And that's such a strange thing for a woman to say, because everything about a woman, and it's a broad brush, right? I mean, there are different people, different types, but everything about the way a young woman grows up, especially as a child, is geared toward the bearing of a child and the nurture of that. And to come to a place where you literally are saying, I have no desire whatsoever to be a woman, it's a strange place we live.
It would seem to me the natural question after that kind of concern is raised, I don't want to have children, coming from a young woman, is what have you been told about having children that you find so repulsive that you find scary?
Right.
What have you been told about it? Because maybe you have been misinformed about what this whole thing is all about.
Yeah, yeah. I think that it's pretty standard belief within our feminist-driven system these days, hyperfeminism, whatever, third wave, whatever you want to call it. It's not just the suffragettes anymore, that having children is to demean yourself. It is to not follow your full potential. Your full potential is to be a lawyer or a doctor or some other thing, none of which is bad. There's nothing wrong with helping people. But for some strange reason, we've just lost the ability to have childbearing like in that picture. And that's the thing that, again, gets back to what we talked about earlier with the demographics. Like, we literally live at a place where we don't believe the future is important. That's what we've come to. Now is important. It's important that I be a doctor or a lawyer, and this goes for men and women, a doctor, a lawyer, a truck driver, doesn't matter. I got to do it now. I got to have my career now. But 40 years from now, my last name having value, my worldview being passed on, none of that matters at all. It's just vaporized.
How much of this on the subject of the college dream, so to speak, is also driven from the parental side? Now, the parents will complain about having to pay for it, but I sometimes wonder if it isn't, if I pay this enormous amount of money, which I actually won't pay, I'm going to make the kid go into debt for it.
Right.
Then they'll get out of the house and I'll be able to live the dream.
Right.
The empty nest followed by a beautiful retirement in side-by-side bathtubs on the beach. That's what I'm looking for. And as soon as I get these kids out of the house, the sooner I can get that dream for myself. Because after all, the kid is the one who's going to is going to graduate with the debt and no job, not me. He might have to live with me, but sooner or later I'll be able to get him out of the house.
Well, it certainly is backfiring though right now with how many are living inside the house and in the basement and whatnot. And I went that route myself. In fact, the only way I got out of the house was going to seminary. I don't know, because I'm not in that generation to see that, but it certainly makes sense what you say. And it's part of the same thing I was just talking about, though. What matters to each of us individually, hedonists as we've become, is the best life I can get for myself now, and the future of my own offspring or their own existence doesn't matter so much as me being able to find whatever American dream I thought I'd been promised and make that come to be.
If we look at the numbers of what happens when kids go to school, incur the debt, and especially if they go on and do graduate school, which they often believe they have to do as well, which sometimes is necessary, and incur the additional debt. And then they get out and the job they have either doesn't support that debt or they don't get the job they were told they were going to get and they have the debt. that becomes self-perpetuating when it comes to the procreation of children.
Yep.
I'm not going to have kids. I owe on my college, and right. I don't have a job sufficient or a job period. What am I going to do right. having kids?
This was when I was a youth pastor. I mean, I was a pastor, but I worked with the youth at the large congregation in Naperville, Illinois. And it was always a very tender conversation, not tedious is the wrong word, but I had to walk carefully because you're dealing with these senior and junior high school boys and girls, and they're asking serious questions. They're asking real life issues, and at a point when they're willing to think about it, but their parents aren't. Their parents are pretty much saying, you're going to college no matter what, and trying to help them understand. Now, this is not a sin for you to do this, but just recognize if you pick this path of, I'm going to go into psychology with the goal of becoming a shrink, that you're not having kids until your 30s at the earliest. And what you just threw into play there is that you're also going to be in debt, so you're not having kids even further on. And so let's just put this in a carnal situation then. So that means you're not having sex for another 15 years. Are you ready for that? And the answer for the world is no, of course not, right? So this is another piece of the whole puzzle. It's like we're throwing these kids without them really realizing what they're getting into this abstinence life that we're going to expect them to hold on to during the period where their body is ready to go. It's ready to be parents. You throw into the mix no support from the church. That is, they're not going to church wherever they are. The binge drinking, the partying, the pressure of what's going on around them. Washington University 2 weeks ago had something called Sex Week, which they do every single week, where it's just a big promotion of apparently having sex somehow, some way, how good it is. And you know, these kids, I mean, we shouldn't be surprised that we're seeing the results we're seeing. Let's just say that. You know, we shouldn't be surprised that so few of them are remaining in church. And as you said, it's going to be self-perpetuating. They're going to have even less kids. We're having two in this last generation. The numbers, if you look at the other countries that are ahead of us because they don't have the immigration that we do, countries like Russia, countries like Sweden, countries like Japan, they're down to the 1.1 or less range. And that's where this is going for this next generation. They're going to be having no or one kid. And this just inverts that pyramid even more so that when you have that 2 billion people left on the planet, those 2 billion people are the top of the pyramid. And it's just going to shrink even more from that. If I wasn't a Christian and didn't believe that Jesus is not going to let the human species die until he's coming back, I would be worried for the species' existence at this point.
Pastor Jonathan Fisk is our guest. When we come back, we're going to talk about another wrinkle in this, and that has to do with the entire panoply of categories that are, in essence, dead ends, non-procreative categories of gender and sexual orientation. They're more than happy to marry and adopt your children, but they're not going to be having any children of their own. We'll talk about all of that on the other side of the break. Our call-in number on this Wednesday afternoon, February the 22nd, 1-877-623-MYIE, and our email address, talkback@issuesetc.org. Where we get the money, honey, I don't know. One more baby's all right by me. We'll just add another limb to the family tree.
Our school is committed to authentic Lutheranism, the entire Book of Concord, and indeed to authentic Lutheranism as it has continued to be confessed and practiced through the centuries right up into our own time.
Dr. Cameron McKenzie, Chairman of the Department of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
We're committed then to biblical, confessional Christianity and Lutheranism and applying it to the world of today in as effective a way as we can.
You can find out more about studying for the pastoral ministry at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, at ctsfw.edu, ctsfw.edu, or call 1-800-481-2155. Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Dr. Anthony Eslin will be speaking on the topic of imagination and education at the second annual Wittenberg Academy Family Retreat, which will be held at Camp Okoboji in Milford, Iowa on April 27th through the 29th, 2017. Join us and be immersed in God's Word, thoughtful discussions, and family fun. For more information or to register, visit www.wittenbergacademy.org and click on the registration tab.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
Theology for Blue Collar, White Collar, and Clerical Collar. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Do you long for a church that celebrates the divine service with reverence and joy, but without the unbiblical baggage imposed by a supposedly infallible hierarchy? Do you long for a church that confesses a divinely instituted office of the holy ministry for the giving of the Lord's gifts to his people, and yet values and lifts high the priesthood of all believers? Welcome to the Lutheran Church. We're what you've been looking for. Find an historic, authentic church near you on the Find a Church page at issuesetc.org.
There are nearly 20 million college students in the United States. 40% will stop going to church during college. 50% will never return. The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod is seeking to meet this challenge through LCMSU. Why? Because 100% of college students matter to God and to His church. College is tough. You need Jesus. We'll help. LCMSU. Check us out at lcms.org/LCMSU.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about Christians, contraception, and the future of the family. Pastor Jonathan Fisk is our guest, host of a radio show called His Time, creative director of Worldview Everlasting TV, author of the book Broken, Seven Christian Rules That Every Christian Ought to Break as Often as Possible. He made a presentation at a recent LCMS Life conference titled Demographic Winter and the Church That Prays for Summer. Have we replaced, based upon everything that we said here in the last few minutes, have we replaced the vocation of parents with, in essence, the American dream for ourselves?
I think we've certainly seen that as the duty of the vocation of parents. I think American parents are still feeding their kids. They're still clothing their kids, right? So they haven't abandoned their job of being parent entirely. Although, as you mentioned before, you do have this sort of, kids are almost like the next level of pet. And I want them for a while, but then they move on, right? They're not a permanent fixture.
Take them out to the country, drop them off at the farm.
Yeah, exactly.
Not have to worry about them anymore.
Exactly. But certainly, it would seem that what we are raising them unto or for is the American dream more than it is the biblical worldview. Because the biblical worldview is that you are to remain faithful unto death. That no matter what comes your way, what tribulation or hardship you might face, the cross of Christ, His word and His sacraments, your baptism into His church, the confession of the creed, catechism, this is life itself, leer erlief, right? Doctrine is life. And I don't think anybody can take an honest look at American Christianity, Lutherans in American Christianity, and what we're doing through the confirmation process or Sunday school or youth group compared to their regular education, their college education, their sports education, and say that we have their faith as our primary goal and focus. It's the reason I'm raising these children is to be Christians. I just don't think we can say that. And that's a fair concern. And it's like we were talking about before, though. It's like either we begin with repentance all the time, every day. Every day I'm wrong. I wake up, I'm wrong, and I learn to be baptized into Christ. Or I keep going down that road and I say, well, you know, I've got to make sure my kid has a career. Otherwise, how are they going to support themselves? Well, I'm not saying you shouldn't do that. I'm not saying you don't want to teach your kid to support themselves. I got five. I'm worried about it just as much as anybody else. But what I'm saying is, what's my priority and what is the ultimate support that they need? And for my family, what I hope I'm doing, I'm pretty much a failure at it. We can talk about my own guilt over not being a good parent or a perfect parent. I think everybody deals with that. But my own hope and my own goal, and I'll just say it the way I said to my kids, I've told them there's nothing you can do in life that will make me not love you. The only way you can ever disappoint me is that you stop being a Christian and a Lutheran. And I've said that to them in no uncertain terms when they're very young, because I want that guilt to be with them the day that they walk away. You know, I want them to know that that's what I care about more than anything else. As much as I like the Trailblazers, as much as I enjoy video games, as much as I hope that they marry rich and I retire on a beach with the double bathtub like you were talking about or whatever, none of that holds a candle to me seeing them in eternity.
And we often hear, and it has been a perpetual alarm sounded in the church, that our youth grow up to a certain age and then they exit the church and they never come back. Mm. Can we at least begin to admit that much of what we talked about here in this hour is a major contributing factor to that? We have taught our children by what priorities we have set for them and for ourselves what's really important, and they've learned what's really important is getting out of the house, away from mom and dad, being self-sufficient, and starting this vicious cycle of education debt and all these things all over again with fewer children than I grew up with in my family.
Yeah, I think our kids have the worldview that we give them, and that's the worldview that's in the house with them. So it's not just about the kids, it's about the parents and the families themselves. It's about we as Christians, it's about us, it's church. And I think to be fair to us, nobody saw television coming. Nobody saw the power that medium had on the home and the mentality in the home. It is, there's this proverbial frog in the pot that's slowly brought to the boil. And people say that, and it's kind of lost its power, but that is what the TV has the power to do to your worldview. And I'm not anti-TV. I try to say this as often as I can. I'm not anti-television. I believe it's a good thing. It's why we have Worldview Everlasting TV. It's a tool. But if you think that thing's on 7 hours a day in your home and it's not changing how you think, you're nuts. And so it's as much about the parents having been boiled into this American mindset, which is progressive, postmodern, anti-family, anti-child, pro-hedonism, consumerism, as in anything. And the kids, of course, the kids are our kids. And we have to own that. If the kids turn out a certain way, we can't sit back and be like, well, and this is the thing that hurts you. I've heard it said to me. I've heard it when people complain about the way we try to raise our kids, which is very, I don't think it's that severe, but, you know, we don't show them TV till they're five and we don't give them sugar all the time and stuff like that. People kind of, they'll say to me, well, you can't protect them from everything, as if that means I shouldn't try. Right? I mean, isn't that what I exist for as a father, is to protect them from everything?
I think I'd like a pet cobra.
Yeah.
Because I can't protect them from everything.
And so, obviously, I can't protect them from everything, but I want to do is protect them, and I want to teach them how to protect themselves. And to me, so it's not just about you know, over-discipline and keeping them from ever seeing the world. It's about equipping them to engage the world. And I just, how do we recapture that? I don't know if I got answers to that, but what I can tell you is if we don't, we're going to keep doing what we're doing. The product's going to be the same one we've been getting.
Let's talk about what I call a whole series of categories that have been introduced into our American thinking in the last, couple years. They will tell us that they've been there since the beginning of time. I call them dead-end categories of human sexuality orientation, where someone says, I'm transgendered, or I'm homosexual, or all these things, where if lived out, there will be no kids.
Yeah.
Zero children.
Yeah.
The only children that those couples may have will be borrowed or adopted from someone else. Not against adoption, but they will be borrowed from someone else. Talk about this.
Yeah. And I mean, this actually did come up at the thing we're going to talk about in the next statement, the Washington U presentation I did. One of the questions coming out of that was, you know, you're saying all this about demographics. You're saying that you need X and Y chromosomes coming together in a womb for the future of the human species. So you're not really speaking against homosexuality, then you're just speaking for procreation. And I was kind of like, well, yeah, that's actually why I came. I wasn't here to try to hit homosexuality for some reason. I mean, that's been done. But if you do that, and I threw out, you know, is it 3%? Is it 11%? I think it's 3%. Let's not argue about it. Let's pretend it's 11%. If it's 11% of the population that's homosexual and not procreating, then that 2.13 is not 2.13 anymore. That number exists as if we're all heterosexuals. If you have another 25% of the population that's cohabiting and deciding we're never going to procreate, now it's not 2.13 to sustain ourselves either. Now it becomes a whole nother level. And so it again betrays the weirdness of the times we live in, that
people will assert, as atheistic evolutionists, they will assert that they've evolved to the point where they're not going to procreate anymore, even though the only way we evolve is procreation in their worldview. It's a bizarre, bizarre thing. It's so counterintuitive. It really, and I don't know if this will hold up scientifically, but I was just thinking about it because of this conversation the other day. Like, this whole, there's a gay gene, there's a homosexual gene. Well, if there was, it would by definition be so regressive, it would breed itself out and it would have been gone years and years and years and years ago.
Because you wouldn't be procreating.
You can't pass it on, right? It would just be gone, right? It's a strange thing. They're trumpeting being the least fit. That's what they're saying they are. And yet at the same time, they want us Christians. We're the only ones who are like, well, survival of the fittest is actually bad for civilization. It's actually breeding hate and then leads to things like Hitler. And we're the ones that are the hateful ones, right? When everything about their own worldview should condemn them. And instead it's not. It shows you that, I don't want to say schizophrenia, that's the wrong disease, the multiple personality disorder, or the postmodern cherry picking that's taking place in this worldview. But yes, absolutely, there are so-called sexual persuasions and or genders at this point that officially can't exist past where they are. And that plays a role in this. I think that's like the side fruit of the tree. The root is something that's much, much deeper. The homosexual gender, transgender, all this is what happens when you've already rejected X and Y being what marriage is.
But if marriage is, if its primary purpose is procreation, I think we would agree on that, and marriage as an idea is rejected, then it seems to me that the next step is, then I kind of, with procreation taken out of the picture, my sexuality has nothing to do with procreation, ultimately. Yep. It may even be a sexuality that meticulously avoids procreation, and that could be any orientation. Once those two are disconnected from one another, does it surprise you that college kids are saying, well, I'm that, next week I might be something else?
No, because it gets back to that, whatever is in front of me that will be pleasurable, that's the thing that matters now. And so as you're seeing this, they can change their genders back and forth. They can have, what is it? I don't even know the list of 35 of them. I can't even imagine what that means, but I know there's some of those that are like both ands and maybes, ors, and all that kind of stuff. No, it's not surprising at all, because when pleasure is the only truth, there's no stability at all. It's going to be changing, 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 changing.
We're going to talk on the other side of the break about a presentation that Jonathan made at Washington University titled The Original Diversity, Man and Woman in Christ. You heard him mention it a moment ago, but we'll go into some detail about what he had to say there and some of the reaction and protest that it has garnered. On this Wednesday afternoon, February the 22nd, I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc.
This is a message for members of Thrivent Financial for Lutherans. Thrivent Financial has a charitable grant program called Thrivent Choice. Thrivent Choice allows you to designate charitable outreach funds to Lutheran Public Radio. For more information, look for the Thrivent logo under the Donate page of our website, issuesetc.org, or ask your Thrivent representative about Thrivent Choice. Help support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. with Thrivent Choice.
Have you been too busy to get your associate's, bachelor's, or master's degree? Concordia University, Wisconsin offers 50 online educational options. Find out more at issuesetc.org. Click the Concordia University online logo and enter the program code ISSUES to waive your application fee. Concordia University, Wisconsin is here to strengthen and support the church. Lifelong Lutheran learning. issuesetc.org and click Concordia University, Wisconsin online.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Celebrate the 500th anniversary of the Reformation with the new Martin Luther plush figure. It features the 16th century reformer holding the Bible and Luther's morning and evening prayers. Go to reformationgear.com, use the coupon code ISSUESETC,
and 20% of your purchase will help support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. ReformationGear.com, the new Martin Luther plush figure, ReformationGear.com, and enter the coupon code ISSUESETC.
Metro East Lutheran High School in Edwardsville, Illinois, engages young adults in a Christ-centered environment, delivering academic excellence and spiritual growth to develop Christian leaders for tomorrow. We provide a Christ-focused alternative to public high schools. Many of our students receive tuition assistance. To help us provide tuition assistance to more students, go to melhs.org and click on the giving page, or call me, Dr. J. Krause, principal, at 618-656-0043.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Pastor Jonathan Fisk is our guest. He is creative director of Worldview Everlasting Television. You can find out more about Worldview Everlasting TV under the Listen On Demand page at issuesetc.org. Jonathan, you were recently at Washington University making a presentation on what you called the original diversity. And you kind of gave us a little introduction before the break. I wanted to talk about not only what you had to say there, but the reaction that was there, even before you actually spoke, there was some preemptive protest of what they thought you were going to say, and in a lot of ways, who they thought you were going to be when you showed up on campus.
Right. What was it? So, I mean, there was this Sex Week thing 2 weeks ago, and the Lutheran Student Fellowship Group on campus knew that was coming. It happens every year. And they thought, you know, this year, let's offer a Bible study to kind of be a Christian view of sex, since this is about Sex Week and people sharing what they think about sex. And because of my schedule, and they really wanted me to come and do that with them, because of my schedule, I couldn't be there during the week of Sex Week, but we were able to schedule it for the week after. And initially, I mean, I was asked to have this be a Bible study. We're thinking, oh, you know, maybe there'll be some people a little bit upset about it. We might get one or two hecklers that show up. Maybe we'll get a couple other Christians on campus to come and listen to this thing. But then the student group got pretty proactive about it, and they put some flyers around, some fairly big ones, and this elicited a op-ed piece in the student newspaper called Stud Life, which went back, and they must have watched one of my videos from somewhere and cherry-picked a couple of lines out of there. To try to make me sound as if I am, and I don't have the line in front of me, but a homophobic, transphobic, fear-mongering, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and really kind of stirred things up in the sense where they said they will have a protest against people like me being allowed to speak at the campus, which, again, I was not invited by the campus. This was not a lecture series. This was a Lutheran student Bible group having me in to talk about what the Bible says. So it's a Christian group for Christians. But
So these protesters were strong advocates of the First Amendment,
no,
free speech.
Yeah. There's the irony of this thing. I mean, the article, it was so back and forth. In one sentence, they say that they want to show that Washington University is a campus in which people of every religion have their viewpoints respected, and so this guy should not be allowed to speak here, right? You just wonder. I mean, do they even know what they're saying, or was this just something that they were fed by their teacher and they're putting together? I mean, it's really hard to know. So they get a protest set up to be going at the same time as my talk in the same building, and it turned out to be pretty civil, which we didn't know how it was going to look initially. We made sure that there was going to be security there, 4 security guards from the campus police there and whatnot. But overall, I think the university, my hat's off to them. They handled it well. They got both groups to at least converse with each other a little bit and respect each other's space. And so they held their thing down in the kind of main room that it was, and we were up in this lecture hall. The lecture hall held 91 people. I was told there was a clicker, so they would not let it overflow, but it seemed pretty full to me. We had at least, I would say, 10, maybe 12 people that came that were not Christian, that listened, did not heckle, came up and spoke with me afterwards. There was what I would call civil discussion, which, it, you know, going in and knowing what's going on, I made the first half of my presentation about having civil discussion and how we need to do that if we're going to get through this together as a nation. And they appreciated that. But at the same time, you know, there were various speakers down below that read, again, the article was read, and so these names were given to me. These are people that never come to hear what I had to say. They're vilifying me. There was a gender studies professor who I'm told said some pretty crass things about me. I wasn't able to be down there to listen. But then also there was a female pastor as well that made sure that everyone knew that I did not know the real Christ, which I found that doubly
wonderfully ironic in that we mean Missouri Synod people who are always condemning everybody. We go to great lengths not to call heterodox Christians non-Christian, right? Even the LCA, you know, we're not going to condemn you as long as you're Trinitarian, and yet they won't give us the same charity. I have to kind of smirk at that. But overall, I was really, really glad that it was, at the very least, it was civil discourse as it should happen, in that there was no violence. Both parties were given platforms to say what they wanted to say. And in theory, the marketplace of ideas was allowed to work. And I think we have the best ideas, so I'm happy when that happens.
What, in essence, did you say that night?
So initially, I'd planned to just talk about, for these Christians that were gathering, most of what I had talked about in that March for Life event. So marriage being something that is an answer to the demographic problem, and procreation being part of marriage. As Christians, we believe this, we've always believed this, so we should challenge the assumptions of the present age, kind of the conversation we've been having here in a little bit. But knowing that there was a protest going on, knowing that I was being called certain types of words, I decided to end around a little bit on that, and instead, initially, make the argument that if you're going to argue against Christianity, you have to understand that our foundational platform is love is patient, love is kind. It does not rejoice in wrong, but gently seeks the truth. And insisting that that's where I'm coming from, that's what I believe, and that if you don't believe what I believe about marriage, it doesn't mean that I hate you. It doesn't mean that I disrespect you. It means I disagree with you. But as a Christian, before anything else, I will tolerate you. And I think it's valuable if you tolerate me. And if we're going to find a way to live together as a civilization, then we have to do that and keep having the conversation, even if, again, we disagree. So moving from that idea that the foundational ethic of Christianity is love, and that Jesus taught us that, I moved into talking about how why you'd believe this as a Christian is because Jesus has risen from the dead. I mean, that's what we want to be known for, not being anti-gay. We want to be pro-forgiveness of sins. That's what we're all about. But then because Jesus has risen from the dead, we also believe the things he says about the way the world is, and he's really clear when talking with the Pharisees about marriage. Have you not read that from the beginning, he who made them male and female, so that the two could be one flesh? So let no one separate what God has joined together. And then that was the jumping off point to male and female are the original diversity. The word diversity gets thrown around a lot today, but usually it means homogeneity, right? We're going to scream diversity at you until you're just like us. But God created man and woman binary, different, hetero, diverse. Heterosexuality is diverse sexuality. And that the huge factor in this is that these two become one flesh, that you have parts of each that are so different from each other that they aren't each other, but when they combine, they become another, they become a third. And that is marriage in its most scientific or design-oriented matter, that new child, that new human exists because of man and woman being different, and that as Christians, we're at least going to say to the culture, this is still a good thing.
To wrap all of this up, Jonathan, someone might have listened and said, wow, I mean, if these numbers are to be believed about the demographic winter that we have brought upon ourselves and that we can't get off this rail, not only will society survive, they might even ask the probably more pressing question, will the Christian church survive this? What's your answer to that question?
Like I said before, if I wasn't a Christian, I'd be worried about the survival of the human species, but I am a Christian. And so because Jesus has risen from the dead, because he said, I will build my church and the gates of hell will not prevail against it, I know with confidence that the church will survive whatever comes through whatever culture it's in. It doesn't mean that the church will survive in that place. The way the church doesn't survive in a certain place is it lets go of his word. And this is one of those moments where we have to ask, are we going to hold on to this word of marriage? And we can't hold on to it saying no homosexuals and no kids either. We're really being shoved into that corner where we either are going to repent and believe that marriage has offspring as a part of it. You said primary earlier, it's at least one of three parts of marriage, the other two being companionship and pleasure. And those are real. Those are good. Either we're going to rediscover that, or we're going to continue to say, I've done nothing wrong. And the problem with saying I've done nothing wrong is now I'm no longer confessing my sins. And so when I'm not confessing my sins, how am I receiving forgiveness? If the church is going to survive
where it will survive, because it will survive, it will do so on the forgiveness of sins. And in that, fear not, if you go to a church where you're still getting that preached, raise your children to seek that kind of a church, raise your sons to be pastors of that kind of a church, and again, trust in what Jesus' promises are, not in our own ability to fix it.
Pastor Jonathan Fiske is host of a radio talk show called His Time, creative director of Worldview Everlasting TV, author of the book Broken, Seven Christian Rules That Every Christian Ought to Break As Often As Possible. He made a presentation at a recent LCMS Life conference titled Demographic Winter and the Church That Prays for Summer. Jonathan, thanks for being our guest.
Yeah, thanks for having me here.
Folks, Concordia University, Wisconsin is committed to lifelong Lutheran learning. They offer 50 online educational options for an associate's, bachelor's, or master's degree, and they'll even waive your application fee when you use the promo code ISSUES. That's ISSUES. Find out more by clicking Concordia University, Wisconsin online logo at issuesetc.org. Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we're going to be reviewing a dark movie, but it's Oscar-nominated. It's called Manchester by the Sea with Pastor Ted Giese. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.